Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast, where today we talk European equities and we'll be focusing on the banking sector. And that follows neatly on from our most recent recording where we did just the same in the US and we did that with JP Morgan. But today we're speaking to Hans Ulrich of GAM. He's their leading European fund manager within the value space. And as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about banks. And here's just one astounding and short clip from Hans as to the opportunity within the banking space.
Currently, we do have 67 percentage points of absolute upside to fair value.
Okay, well, for some more colour behind that extremely bullish position, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. Today we're going to be discussing European equities and on that basis delighted to welcome our special guest Hans Ulrich from GAM, lead manager on their Euroland Value Equity Fund. I think the thread of the conversation will be an assessment of the current conditions in the European economy and how that's leading into Hans's investment strategy. And then I think, as is always the case with value investing, there are a couple of names that caught a bit of controversy, so it would be good to have some insight into that. So Hans, as I said, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you.
If we look at the European economy, it's still growing quite nicely, but up against some pretty lofty expectations, I think, going into 2018. There are some sort of modest disappointments coming in, as I said, missing some lofty expectations. Is this something that concerns you, or are you broadly still pretty positive about the European economy?
Yeah, no, when one looks at the various industries, one has to differentiate between the classical value representatives, i.e. the cyclicals and the financials. And for the last 2.5 years, they keep enjoying the biggest positive earnings revision ratios. So that is unbroken, and that's exactly what we're exposed to. Whereas the disappointment is actually coming from the overvalued bits in the quality growth space. You know, it's the quality and the consumer staple stocks, which just keep having top-line problems, and which have been experiencing negative earnings revision ratios for the last 2.5 years. So that's more from a bottom-up basis. Top-down, I think what the press doesn't really understand is that PMIs cannot go up forever. Okay, once you reach the high 50s, they will start to level out. That's what always happens historically, because you have to imagine you start rebuilding inventories. And if you buy 100 units per week, you cannot continue to buy 100 units and replenish that, because eventually you stop, or you basically reduce that to buying 80 units. And that's exactly what happens when these PMIs temporarily start to slow down. On top of that, what we had seen in Q1 is a big weather effect globally, okay, which had as well some negative impact on certain demand growth patterns. And it wouldn't surprise me at all that basically going into sort of late April, early May, we will just see a pickup again. So what we have to be aware is that we have, for 3 months in a row, exceeded the record PMIs that we had at the peak of the previous cycles, 2007 and 2011, the rebound post the Euroland crisis. So we are at exceptionally high levels, and levels that we hadn't seen for 10 years.
Okay, well, I guess that's no doubt the explanation, but I guess some of the more cautious on the region may cite that, you know, the euro's been a bit strong. Well, it's been incredibly strong, mm-hmm. I guess, and yet, you know, inflationary pressures, mm-hmm. well, certainly the headline numbers and core numbers aren't coming through, and the central bank therefore may need to. So because the euro's been strong, it's been a bit deflationary, a bit damaging to growth, and the central bank may need to be a little bit more cautious in its ambitions to move on interest rates. And I guess that type of story may be concerning given your investment investment position.
There's two aspects to this. One is the tax cut that we have that we're getting in the United States, and the other one is obviously, as you're correctly pointing out, euro's appreciated some 17% in the last 13, 14 months. Had we, or were we, in a situation as we were back in 2012, where we had just the emergence of the economic cycle to come into existence, that would be very strongly felt. Since we now have the strongest top-line growth that we had in 10 years, that's just literally, it's just absorbed. Okay, we have the luxury of having very strong top-line growth. And even though you could say, okay, for certain business models, that's a 500-600 basis points year-on-year impact, or over that 14-month period negative impact, the vast majority of that is actually already going to be compensated by the tax cuts in the United States. So net-net, because we have that strong economic growth, no difference whatsoever.
Okay, and you sort of mentioned the US there, and obviously Europe's at a different stage in the cycle. I'd be sort of interested to sort of, you know, we're talking, it's not imminent, actually. Well, it doesn't appear to be imminent, the end of the cycle in the US, but it is at least sort of being discussed a bit more frequently. But just be interested to know what sort of runway you're sort of looking at in terms of, you know, where we are in the European cycle. It still looks like there's a long way to go.
A very long way to go, because what we have to be aware is we had 10 years of crisis. Fiscal tightening, which was imposed on us because of the Euroland crisis from 2011 to 2015, wiped out 1.2% equivalent of GDP every year. Okay, that's the reason why we had neither an industrial nor an economic cycle. Now, since sort of 2014, 2015, we have an ever-accelerating economic cycle. And when you look at history, these cycles, they usually last 5 to 7 years. So we're sort of into the third year of the economic recovery. So there's a very long way to go. Since we do have capex to sales at 30-year lows, okay, because of the crisis, you know, people didn't have the free cash flow, so they had to first make the profits, create the equity, etc., in order to have the free cash flow again. Today, all our companies are profitable. They're sloshing free cash flow. They completely deleveraged their balance sheets. With a capex to sales at the 30-year low, we're going to get, presumably, highly likely, a very extended cycle, because companies now have to redeploy that surplus free cash flow. Since we have basically allocated all the emerging markets in the last economic cycle, there's no stupid acquisitions that they can waste that money on. So basically, they can really do value-enhancing, you know, zero-premium mergers, cost-cutting, etc., etc., and they redeploy that money either through the capex side, or what we have seen for the last 9 years in the US. The US has bought back $3.8 trillion worth of equity, enhancing the earnings growth by 40 percentage points artificially. That's only starting 2019 for the Europeans, and that's really going to be the icing on the cake.
And, you know, as a value manager, I'm sure there are... you will do your best during periods where it's out of favour, but you know, this you would say has been and will continue to be a nice sort of sweet spot for value style investing.
Absolutely, I think, you know, to better position the product, we're not a style fund. We are valuation based investors. That means we're just going wherever valuations are most distorted or most mispriced. The good thing is, in the last 5 years, where values of style has underperformed 552 basis points, we position number one and number two respectively in our two funds, and that shows that we are not a style fund, because obviously a style fund can only deliver when it has style tailwind. And I think that's the key attraction actually of the product. So we, having already produced some 500 plus basis points per annum compound in these difficult 5 years for value, you may imagine what sort of alpha we're going to produce when that headwind finally ceases.
Okay, well, I've got dollar signs in my eye, or euro signs in my eyes over that one. Okay, so you're moving into, you're firmly into in the traditional value sectors in a focused way, and you have a big position in the banking sector. I mean, it'd be great to talk about a couple of names, but, you know, remind us of the investment case.
Yeah. What we have currently, the structure that we currently have, we have a strong exposure to financials, we have a strong exposure to energy, materials or cyclicals, okay? Because the way the market is currently pricing those sectors, they're all trading below 10 times forward earnings. They're all profitable. They're all trading between 0.35 and 0.9 book. And they're paying us dividend yields of 4.5% to 7.5% on very modest payout ratios of 45% to 50%. And they're growing because of the economic cycle. They're growing their earnings in the teens. So it's literally, it is paradise. The reason they are priced like that is because the market is anticipating, as you hinted initially in your initial questions, that at the end of the year we would go back into some sort of recession or massive slowdown. And when you look at the financials, what they are pricing in is that at the end of this year we would go back to deflation, Japan style, whatever, 30-year deflation. And I think that's the biggest opportunity that we currently have. And I'm doing this now for 30 years and I've never, ever had that visibility. 95% of our companies do report on a quarterly basis, normalized margins, earnings, and free cash flow. I don't have to anticipate anything. I don't care what the economic cycle does. I don't care what inflation does. I know it's reflating currently, as we see on all the fronts. And we just have a complete misunderstanding from the market. So that's the beauty of it. And I've never had that before. What is it worth? Okay, when historically ever we had that visibility that we currently have, our average upside to fair value sort of converged towards 15-17%. Yeah, because the more visibility you have, the less upside is left. And then usually that stays for the next 3, 4, 5 years, as long as the cycle goes. And when we go into the next crisis, then less visibility, more upside to fair value. Currently, we do have 67 percentage points of absolute upside to fair value. So basically, the market, because of this dichotomy that managed to build itself over the last 10 years, which I'm addressing very vocally in that paper that I published mid-January, going from a growth to a value bubble, we are being paid 50 percentage points absolute upside, which simply at this stage of the cycle, with the visibility that we do enjoy, should not be there anymore.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you talk about visibility. I mean, that overall thesis looks perfectly sound, but I mean, one of the names that I'm sure it gets discussed a lot that's in the portfolio is Deutsche Bank. I mean, it does seem to be one of those businesses where, you know, visibility is a bit of a, is more of a question mark. I mean, I wonder whether if you could explain to us how you could arrive at a valuation for that business.
Yeah. Deutsche Bank, you know, there's obviously a big misconception. That's one of the misconceptions I'm addressing in that paper as well, you know, and it's put in a fairly provocative way. FinTech eats the lunch of the structurally challenged banks. The reason I've written this paper is because all these have had to be confronted with all the interviews with all these misconceptions. And I just got sick and tired, so I wrote it down and disseminate that before I go into the meetings. So basically, banks, as apart from Deutsche, we are fully exposed to retail banks. Retail banks is an extremely visible, okay, highly stable business model. Two-thirds of it comes from interest rate differentials between mortgages or lending and the deposit business. Highly visible, very recurring. One-third of that usually comes from the fee-based business, FX, whatever. You go on holidays, you do what you need to. Raise some cash at the ATM, they charge you for 300, 500 basis points. It's a very profitable, highly visible repeat business that we do have. The 30% that you do have in the retail business, which is so-called investment bank, there's no proprietary trading. It's just the 30% FX, etc., structured products that is there to facilitate that 70% of revenues from the private clients. Okay, someone needs to execute those transactions. So it's a very, very highly visible business model. When it comes to valuations, what we had historically, we had huge boom-bust loan cycles. Yeah, leveraged, housing market collapsed, and then you had the massive write-downs for 2-3 years, and eventually wrote back because the people got back on their feet again and managed to pay and service debt, and he had to write it back. Now, with all this massive regulation that has happened in the last 10 years, going forward, we're going to have very small loan cycles because regulation just doesn't allow it anymore. And the discipline and the systems that have been built within banks, they've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions each on basically tracking and allowing them to manage those loan cycles will create very small loan cycles going forward. That argues that banks which currently trade at 0.35 to 0.9 times book, they're all profitable. And they have, that's the fascinating thing, been profitable throughout the two systemic crises every quarter. Okay, not that anyone would have noticed, but that's what actually they delivered. So basically that means, where should they trade up to? Okay, what is normal in this low interest rate or basically loan cycle volatility? It's very simple. We just have to look at the Scandis, because that's what they have. They have a different nature in the business, and they have very low loan cycle volatility. Those trade between 1.5 to 2.5 times book. They have not much more core tier one equity than the continental Europeans. And they are now going into an NPL cycle, whereas the Europeans are still well into reducing their cost of capital, because they're constantly right back, because clients just get back on their feet again. So they are at the other end, going into the next NPL cycle, trading at 1.5, 2.5 times book. We are still in the sweet spot, and we're trading between 0.35 and 0.9 times book. So it's very visible that most of those banks will just double over the next, whatever, 18, 24 months. And that's what they should.
Well, I mean, sorry to, I know you've written in your paper then about Deutsche Bank, but just to one final point on that, you sort of seem to suggest that the market underestimates the importance of it, what, its retail franchise, mm-hmm. or its move towards more of a retail?
Deutsche is investment banks, this is like a steel company. It's all about scale. What Deutsche didn't do, because it didn't have the equity, because of the Lehman crisis followed by the Euroland crisis, it didn't have enough equity. So it could not do the investments into the IT that it should have done. And when John Crane took over some 3 years ago, they had 44 different legacy systems. He's done a great job. Unfortunately, he didn't get the credit for it, and has now been sacked for it because it didn't go fast enough. But he's actually initiated all the right things. When you look at the difference between Deutsche and Goldman Sachs obviously being the most profitable bank, they enjoy ROEs double of what Deutsche has. It all boils down to systems. Because whether you generate 5 billion or 6 billion or 7 billion of volume, if you have the right IT system, you don't need to hire an incremental headcount. It's just straight to the bottom line. It's a hugely leveraged business model. Now, Deutsche was unlucky to have that slowdown in the revenues. So if the top line comes down, you're like a steel company. If capacity utilization goes down to 50%, you have a very, very tough time. And at the same time, you're required to spend much more than what historically you have spent on making the transition to the IT. That's what you had seen in the last, whatever, 2-3 quarters. And at the end of the day, they obviously do depend. They have to have more volatility in the market. And as we see on a daily basis, we do get more volatility. We've been in a zero volatility environment for factually 3 years. And that's made it very difficult, because if you have a business and you think, okay, should I hedge the currency? Well, there is no volatility. I don't hedge it. Well, if you have Brexit, then suddenly you have an interest in hedging your currency, because there is volatility. And that's exactly what's led to a strong decline in the revenue base of all those investment banks, because people stopped hedging. The end of January, early February, we got a tiny vol spike and all the hedging is back. The Americans, which are just reporting, JP yesterday, Morgan Stanley today, massive explosion in their revenues, because people are hedging again, people are again active in the various instruments because volatility is back. And that will become stronger and stronger over the next couple of quarters.
Well, I do want to allow you to talk about a couple of other areas in your portfolio, but just, Italian banks, before we move on, Italian banks, there's clearly a presence in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. Could you just sort of remind us, at a casual glance, one might think that, gridlock in Italian politics would mean that reform efforts are sort of almost sort of permanently delayed in that mm-hmm. sector. You know, is there... To what extent is your investment thesis derailed by that sort of political obstructionism?
Not affected at all, because that's the good thing. You know, when you look at France, which basically had a disastrous political system for the last however many years I can think back. Fortunately, we do have corporates that focus on their business. They do their daily jobs, and that's exactly the same thing in Italy. All those banks, Banco BPI or basically UniCredit, which is the largest Italian banks, they have very dedicated restructuring programs. They have already shipped off a lot of their NPEs, non-performing equities or loans, and are constantly doing new deals. It's interesting, Intesa Sao Paulo just did a deal the day before yesterday, and whereas the average had been settled so far at sort of 30 cents to the euro, we suddenly get now, because of the massive interest from the private equity guys, because these guys are sitting on cash and don't know where to redeploy it, so they start paying up, okay? So whereas previously we had some 29 cents to the euro, now Intesa Sao Paulo has done a transaction with 35 cents. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but this is huge, because they just sold over 11 billion of their portfolio. Now we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of million of incremental profit that they generate out of selling their non-performing debt. So this is going to be an ongoing feature over the next 18 months. And I think within 18 months, other than the very small Italian banks, which have no systemic relevance whatsoever, that will be done.
Okay, well, we'll move on from financials. And it's sort of an open platform, really. I know it's a very a focused fund, so you're no doubt extremely keen on all positions within the strategy. But you mentioned energy. You know, you've got some retail in there. You know, any other areas that you, like I said, all of it's worth talking about, but you're sort of keen to express.
Yeah, as we addressed as well in the paper we published in January, it's these misconceptions like, Tesla eats it all, which gave us a great opportunity to enter the car space at very cheap valuations. Amazon eats it all. That's why we have the overweight in the food retailers, because the market doesn't really understand that hard retailing, where Amazon is very strong and dominant, is completely different from food retailing, which is a perishable business. And you cannot just put away the food until demand is there and then you ship it out container-wise. It's a completely different dynamics. And Amazon strike back Tesco started in 1999 together with Ocado. So all three of them basically started at the same time. And if anything, even though Amazon could throw as much money at the business as they want, because they have it, the gap between them and the other two has become bigger and bigger. So money alone doesn't, solve that situation. The other thing is shale gas eats it all, as we addressed as well in the paper. It's a complete, misunderstanding about the dynamics of shale gas. Shale gas, just to sum that up, because that's a key driver as well, in which then leads into inflation and higher oil prices, which again lead into heating costs, i.e. leading to higher rents, which goes into the core CPI rates. So basically, the market thinks that shale gas can just endlessly continue to produce and that they have break-even points in the $35 range. Now, when we look last year, we had an average oil price of 52.5. And then we look at the whole shale universe in the United States. It had as they claim, average break-even points of about $35, $40, they should have created twice the free cash flow that they have generated. Now, what the industry has done, and that's led to some oversupply towards the end of this year, is that they have deployed the best of rigs with the best of their teams to the best acreages. That's what helped you generate that. Now, once you've used the best teams, the best acreages, and the best rigs, you need to go to the second best rigs, to the second best teams, and the teams are extremely important to define the efficiency of the productivity of the well. And that's exactly what we're seeing. There is obviously a delay, because when they start, there's other than 6, 7, 9 months where the oil, is coming out at that speed. And we're already seeing it now that this rate is now slowing down. Totally, we produce 100 or consume 100 million barrels per day, and the US is 10 out of that, and shale is 5. So literally just 5% of that comes from the shale area. We said, okay, just assume they're going to double that output. Yeah, that would be an incremental demand of 1.3 million barrels per day. We have a demand growth of 1.8 million barrels per day. It doesn't matter. The demand is so superior to what, even if they doubled, which they're not going to do, that it's going to be absorbed. And OPEC, as they just discussed 2 days ago, they have a firm interest because they need it for their budgets, that they will just extend this from at the end of this year into 2019, this 1.8 million barrels that they cleverly have taken out. At the same time, we had seen some inventory build in Q1, which the market again, you know, said, oh God, this is now over. We've had a big inventory drawdown and now we're going to build again because of shale gas. It's utter bullshit, you know. The reason that basically happens is because in Q1, the refineries make the maintenance shutdowns. And obviously, if they don't consume, because they consume about a third of the oil, of the crude oil, yeah, then you start building inventory again. And already last week's and previous week's figures we had again seen we reverted to that 15 to 20 million barrels of drawdown per month, which by sort of September will make or bring the long-term averages or bring the averages of the inventories back to the long-term averages. Whenever they came back to long-term averages, you go into a deficit.
Okay, well, before we sign off, just one last question on ArcelorMittal in the portfolio. Clearly, it's a bit a cyclical name, and with growth maybe peaking around the developed world, that could come under pressure. But also interested in sort of the trade war angle. To what extent that is creating some uncertainty in the stock, or indeed an opportunity?
Yeah. It obviously created, sentiment-wise, it created temporarily some weakness because the market doesn't understand what these trade, potential trade tariffs mean. It's actually the biggest winner, ironically. How come? All those major companies have actually a strong manufacturing basis in US. The quality, this high-performance steel that predominantly ArcelorMittal produces, is a quality of steel that the Americans cannot produce. Okay, so what's going to happen is they will be allowed to. I don't think it ever comes because it would be so detrimental to the established American economy, and I think Trump eventually will realize that. But basically, if they increase rates by 25%, what we do see, there's some old 30, 40, 50 year old furnaces coming on stream. They will create 500 jobs here, 500 jobs there. The problem is, and that's the reason why they are unprofitable. They've never invested for the last 40 years. Similar thing as in the UK. Ever since Thatcher and Reagan took over, the manufacturing investment activity came down to a trickle. And the problem is, that's why they are most exposed. They are delivering or producing the entry-level quality, the lowest quality steel, cement, blah, 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 where they actually are directly confronted with the mass exports and the flooding from the Chinese entry players. Okay. Now, ArcelorMittal is producing the top-line steel, which is going into the car manufacturing industry, which is going into the Caterpillars, which is going into the Deers, which is going into the turbines of the GEs. They will continue to procure that. They just have to pay a higher price. So you may gain a couple of thousand jobs from the steel producers, but you'll lose, you know, a mass multiple of that in the established players like GE, like Caterpillar, and like Deere. And they are actively now lobbying, obviously, against that. Now, the cutoff is May. By May, they can, you know, put down all the complaints that they have. And I think by then, even Trump will have realized that it would be so detrimental to his economy. He's never going to solve that because there is a 750 trillion a billion goods deficit with the Chinese, and no one would ever start any sustainable capacity investment knowing that Trump is going to be gone in 2 years' time. So it's just simply not going to happen. But since this is one of his election claims, he has to show some sort of achievements in that space. The fundamental situation is never going to change.
Okay, well, Hans, thanks so much for giving some insight into not only that stock, but the dynamics of that negotiation. And we take some comfort from that, I guess, ultimately optimistic view. But indeed, we take a lot out of the entire conversation and your thoughts on European equities and in particular those more cyclical areas. So thanks very much, Hans. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewin Podcast. But until next time, many thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot.